Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thank you very much for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with that special group of people that are with us live and not getting us on the podcast, if you are so inclined, you can scroll to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. Go ahead and join us if you'd like with the usual suspects. That's a great place to share any observations you may have during the course of the show. Or if there is a question you would like for us to address to our guest, you can put it in there and we'll be more than happy to fold that in during the course of the conversation this hour. If you have some things you need to take care of and you need to take off before the show is done, remember you can go back and get the full archive of this and all of our shows over at Blog Talk Radio, or take the shortcut, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and you can listen to it at your leisure. Now we're going to get on with the show, and I've been looking for a while for the right person and the right hook to bring the conversation back to the Syrian civil war, and specifically the Turkish intervention, because when the Islamic State Caliphate's territory in Syria, which is now down to a few isolated pockets, they've lost their capital. Some of the interest until in the last few days, for obvious reasons that we'll discuss later on the show, people have been distracted about other things, but there's still a lot going on there with the rebel forces, the Kurds, the Russians, the Iranians, and now, of course, the Turks. The Turks have moved into Afrin province in a strong way, and they're a NATO ally, but they're an ally sometimes of a small A. There's lots of potential spot areas that could lead to trouble down the road, whether with us, Russians, or others. We just don't know. So we'll kind of get an angle of what Turkey might be able to accomplish and how it impacts whether they're Russians, Iranians, or the Syrians supporting Assad, or the rebels, all the different players. And to examine this question related issue, we have our guest for the full hour, Michael Goodyear. Michael is a law student at the University of Michigan Law School, and he has degrees in history and Near Eastern languages and civilizations from the University of Chicago. His research focuses on history, culture, and politics of the Balkans and the Northern Middle East. And in the case y'all haven't had a chance to read it yet, you can find a link over at the show page. But as a starting point to our conversation, we're going to reference a recent article that he had over with our friends at Small Wars Journal, titled Paradigm Shift in Syria After Afrin. Michael, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you so much for having me.
Really appreciate you taking time to spend with us and our listeners. And to kick it off, let's take a moment just to set the table for some of the things that I mentioned in the introduction. There is a lot of news in the last 48 hours about some developments in Syria that, you know, maybe we can get to later on in the show. But I really want to pull the focus back to what you wrote about in your article that I think is of critical importance as the Syrian civil war in many ways is moving, if not to its final or penultimate chapter, but perhaps the second half of the book, for a variety of reasons that we'll touch on in the course of the conversation. But that's the Turkish intervention in Afrin. If you could, for the listeners, just give them a quick background of what is Afrin, why Turkey would want to go into Afrin, and where you think the things may stabilize here.
Sure. So just to briefly cap this. So we started off, of course, several years ago in Syria with the civil war beginning and a variety of different players, both with various factions inside Syria itself, and of course, a whole host of international players stretching from the Arabian Peninsula to Iran, Russia. And really, I kind of was following along very closely to see what Turkey was going to do, since initially the Turkish presence in Syria was not very big and really non-existent. And Turkey kind of took a larger role starting back in 2016, when they decided to make moves against the Islamic State, or ISIS, ISIL-ish, any other terms that it might be referred to. And now that, as you mentioned in the introduction, the Islamic State has, for practical purposes, fallen, although, of course, those pockets still exist, Turkey has kind of shifted its focus, and that would be towards the aforementioned Kurds. And the Kurds exist in a variety of countries in the Middle East, kind of along the border areas of Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria. And in particular, there's a very large group of Kurds inside Turkey. And the Kurdish population makes up about 20%, give or take, of the overall Turkish population. So basically the most sizable, by far, minority they have. And inside that Kurdish minority, there have been movements for independence or autonomy, most notably amongst the PKK, which there was a series of wars in eastern Turkey between the PKK and the Turkish government dating back to the 80s and 90s. And kind of depending on who you talk to, they're considered to at least have terrorist ties and potentially be terrorist groups. The United States recognizes the PKK as a terrorist group, as does NATO, and of course Turkey does as well. And going back to Syria, inside northern Syria, the largest faction that's currently residing there is the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is kind of a larger conglomeration of various different groups, but the bulk of this group and kind of the leaders are the YPG, or the People's Protection Units, which are basically all Kurdish. And there are potentially ties between the YPG and Turkey, and Turkey is very cautious and not very happy about potential autonomous Kurdish units in the region at all. This kind of came up in Iraq as well when the Iraqi Kurds had a referendum at the end of last year for independence, and the Turks were pretty adamant that, you know, this is only going to drive a knife into a further problem, and we're really not very happy about that in the slightest. So the intervention currently in northern Syria is mostly being pronged against the Kurds rather than against the Islamic State, which is why the Turks have originally entered into Syria in the first place. So that's kind of the position we're in right now. As you mentioned, what the article is about the city of Afrin, which was one of the major YPG Kurdish cities in northern Syria, which was firmly under YPG control, and the Turkish army invaded. And now about 2.5 weeks ago, the Turks and the Turkish-backed government opposition forces took control of Afrin city. And kind of in the weeks since, they've been mopping up that quarter of northern Syria and kind of putting it either under Turkish control or under the forces of the Turks back there. So basically pushing the Kurds just now into one contiguous land base, mostly stretching from Manbij, which is kind of the main next target potentially of the Turks, stretching from there, which is in fairly center north Syria, all the way over to the Iraqi border.
And the I think in your article you kind of indicated that that Russia and Iran are kind of okay with Turkey being in that part of Syria. Can you kind of set the background for that and what that means?
Yeah, so I think it's a little more nuanced than just that. So kind of the main key players right now that are foreign powers in Syria are probably Turkey, Russia, and Iran. Actually, the three of them have been somewhat surprisingly trying to work together towards peace, at least nominally. And they have had meetings. There's a meeting in Sochi earlier, a few months ago. They actually just had a meeting between the three countries earlier this week. And then they also have a meeting coming up in Tehran, at least supposedly to discuss peace. And I think at least Russia and Iran are not making moves against Turkey when it comes to the Kurds. But that's kind of just the surface level. And I think Iran is probably the most conflicted one, because when I was discussing kind of the Kurds in the broader region, there is a sizable Kurdish population in Iran as well. So Iranian interests are somewhat similar to Turkish interests in that they don't really want much autonomy for the Kurds, because that could potentially lead to their own Kurdish population demanding autonomy. But at the same time, the Russians and Iranians are kind of on the other side of the Turks in regards to the civil war in Syria. So kind of since the beginning, Russia and Iran have been the major backers of the Assad regime. And Turkey and the Turkish president, Erdogan, have been very staunchly against Assad. I believe Erdogan had a quote a few months ago in Turkish media, which said that if there's going to be peace in Syria, Assad has to go. So notably, Assad is understandably nervous. And I think in part that has led to a sort of rapprochement between the YPG Kurds and Assad, which generally, although they're at least officially at odds with each other, the main pressures of the two forces haven't really been against each other. Assad has been mostly focusing on the rebel opposition forces, and the Kurds YPG have been mostly focusing on the Islamic State, at least until now when Turkey comes in the picture. And so actually the Assad regime was kind of assisting the YPG to a certain degree, and at least allowing Kurdish forces to kind of go through Assad territory from that larger Balkh area that I mentioned, around Manbij, and kind of going over to Afrin to better bolster that and defend it. And potentially there have been some military armed seals and support that way as well. So there was kind of an undercurrent. And actually, it was just on Saturday that the Turks established a forward base that's substantially further south than they have previously, which is actually going more in the direction of Damascus and not in the direction of the Kurds. So that's another signal for Assad that he might be nervous. Certainly Russia and Iran have been major backers, and they, similar to the United States, have had a few troops on the ground, but for the most part, it's been aerial support and financial support. And Turkey's kind of the first major foreign power to actually send an army, or at least substantially back a proxy military force, which is making movements along their border. So I think, at least in the end, these are the three powers that are going to be major players at the table. I think, particularly with Afrin and now with Manbij, some of the questions will kind of rotate around whether the United States or France or any other foreign power will be major players, or whether it will largely be whoever happens to end up in Syria and the Iranians, Russians, and Turks.
One of the things I've said, mostly with tug in cheek, but not really, for over half a decade, is if you want to try to understand what's going on in the Syrian civil war, you need to understand Game of Thrones more than anything else. And one of the things I've been looking at and has been the Turks, and you know, when are the Turks going to move? And when they moved, that's always been a big concerning for me, because you know, you read, especially in the last year, we'll talk about the Turks and the Persians, i.e. the Iranians, are, you know, talking and getting along, or the Turks and the Russians. Well, the Turks and the Persians and the Turks and the Russians, they've been fighting wars with each other for centuries. And the Turks and the Syrians, no love lost there because of the Ottoman Empire and all the fun things that happened there. And when you look at those relationships, not so much the Turks and the Syrians, because as you just outlined there, there's no love lost there. But are people making too much of the Turkish and Iranian moves and the Turk and the Russian moves to get along? Is there really any new alignment that everybody should be looking at? Or are these alliances as fragile and paper thin as history would inform us they probably are?
Yeah, so first I just want to hit on something that you mentioned, Game of Thrones, which actually there is a reference to Game of Thrones in the article that I wrote, which I'm actually quite surprised they managed to let that slide in there. But I do think it's a very very apt comparison, just because everything changes so quickly and there are so many factions involved that you kind of have to keep track of. And it's much more complicated than I think what you often will consider to be like a traditional civil war. I mean, like the one in the United States, for example. Of course, foreign powers had some involvement, but nowhere to the near same scale. And certainly they wouldn't change the degree or change the potential outcome like the Turks are now doing in Syria. But to the historical point of alliances, so I thought one quote that was especially interesting, which was by Hakan Çavuşoğlu, who's a Turkish minister, said that we drove their grandfathers into the sea. This is why they're waging a relentless struggle against us, which refers to kind of the Western powers. This is kind of a relation to France. The Turkish ministry had made kind of a threat against the French government a few days ago. I think this was on Thursday now, which basically said, you know, you're with us or you're with the Kurds, which was kind of one of the major issues I thought came up with the capture of Afrin, of kind of pushing things to the forefront of not being able to sit on the sidelines or sit on the fence anymore. And I think with these, obviously the historical relations are important. And as you had mentioned, I mean, Iran, Turkey, and Russia have historically been very staunch rivals. Russia and Turkey have tended not to get along almost ever in world history. But of course, there are times that can overcome this. And I think, at least when it comes down to it, I think they're probably paper-thin alliances, and each power is kind of using the other ones, and the powers in Syria, for that matter, to their own interests. But at the same time, I think it's important to consider why they're kind of shifting this way. So Turkey, particularly since the attempted coup, which was 2 summers ago in Turkey, President Erdogan has had incredibly autocratic tendencies. He's been cracking down the press, even the military, and has generally been taking a more anti-Western stance. And I think this is in part due to the fact that the United States won't hand over Fethullah Gulen, supposedly mastermind of the coup, at least according to the Erdogan government. I think also the fact that it's good rhetoric with the Turkish population. And I think Erdogan's now in the last few months been having very high numbers of public speeches. I mean, it's basically more speeches than there might be tweets from President Trump. They're such a high degree. But kind of the public rhetoric aspect of being anti-Western at least kind of goes to his main constituents and can help keep him in power. And of course, what's the other main anti-Western kind of symbol or main country right now is Russia and Putin. So I think that's partially driving Turkey closer to Russia. But at the same time, I think it's very important to consider the fact that Turkey itself is kind of in a very key position. I don't think Turkey has any plans to just throw its doors open to Russia and welcome them with open arms, but more to seem that it may or may not be against the West and to use Russia for what it may. Kind of the same with Iran. As I had mentioned, at least Iranian and Turkish interests kind of align on the Kurds, but of course they're still on the opposite sides. And the same with Russia, they're backing different powers in Syria. I do think it will be incredibly difficult for all of those interests to kind of come together, since the Turks are still backing the anti-government groups, which are incredibly fractured and certainly are not doing very well on the map or in regards to military support and that sort of thing, unless Turkey decides to take a further step in the war. And I think that remains to be seen, but certainly there are movements that are going in that direction. Certainly, as I mentioned, that forward base that was substantially further south than they wanted. I think recently, either Saturday or Friday, Turkey said that they wanted to establish a hospital in eastern Ghouta, so one of the closest rebel areas to Damascus itself, eastern Ghouta effectively being a suburb area of Damascus. And I think all those things will at least have to make the Assad government fairly nervous, and in extension, kind of the Russian government and the Iranian government.
What's there's so many players, and you always have to ask the question, what's in it for the main players? And I mean, I always look at Russia and go, they want that port on the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. They want that warm water port. I'm not sure what else they want from Assad. But why are they throwing their weight behind Assad? What's Iran's game in this? Is that they also trying to get to the Mediterranean? And and I guess the last question is, as Turkey goes forward against the Kurds, what's their end game? They're going to, you know, they already denied that there was an Armenian genocide. Are they going to try and just gain control of the territory and hope to wrestle the issue to the ground finally? Or exactly what do you perceive?
Sure. So I think the Mediterranean issue is an interesting one, just because historically that kind of has always been the Russian goal of getting a warm water port, especially in the Mediterranean. I mean, even dating back to the early wars between the Turks and the Russians in the 1700s, Catherine the Great even named her grandson Constantine to retake Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul. So I think that's always been a dream. And I think, at least to an extent, that might have something to do with it. But I think there are potentially different ways Russia could go about getting a warm water port that doesn't involve having to go out of the Crimea and go through the Dardanelles Straits and go through Turkey. And why they're specifically going with Assad, I think Russia has had good relations with the Assad government, and this predates the civil war itself. Assad has proven to be a mild ally, if not a supportive one, in the Middle Eastern region. Russia doesn't really have ties to any other countries in the area, since most of them have better ties to the United States, Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia being main examples. And so I think largely it comes down to that. The Russia wants to keep its influence, and they've kind of already had a deal with Assad, so it made sense for them. They haven't necessarily been engaging anywhere near the same level of resources that Turkey is now trying to put in the ground. Russia's been mostly supplying air support to the Assad regime. But I think it's definitely an important area for their foreign policy, right? And kind of a way in which they can extend their influence, especially since extending influence in Europe for them right now does not necessarily seem to be route for them, especially when kind of the former Soviet republics are starting to lean more towards the European Union or the United States for support in those regions. As to the other main players, I think Iran, there are a few reasons. So Iran has also had historically good relations with Assad. Syria has also kind of been an important highway for supplying arms and resources from the Iranian government to Hezbollah, of course, mostly operating out of Lebanon, effectively controlling the government for many years there. And I think both the Iranian government and Hezbollah are worried that if the new Syrian government might be a majority Sunni government and potentially more aligned with Saudi Arabia or another foreign power that's against the Iranian Hezbollah alliance, that could be very problematic. And those arms just wouldn't go through. Hezbollah's support might be undercut. And that would really hurt the influence of the Shia alliance that exists between them. So those are kind of the two main foreign backers of the Assad regime. And I'm kind of getting here Hezbollah and Iran as the same, so I think a lot of their interests are very similar in that regard, although Hezbollah doesn't really have the same sort of issues with the Kurds that Iran does. For the other major foreign powers, I think the United States, for the most part, the main goal is getting rid of the Islamic State. And that's kind of the main goal under the Obama administration. Still the main goal under the Trump administration. I know there's a little bit of quibbling back and forth whether we're pulling out of Syria earlier this week or not, but at least the current statement from the Trump administration is that we are in fact staying, and the goal is to be removing the Islamic State. Since, of course, I mentioned I think at the beginning of the podcast, the Islamic State has been beaten back, but there are those pockets that still exist. And it's important to make sure that those pockets are extinguished if that goal is to be met. For Turkey, I think Turkey potentially has the most complicated goals, just because the main goal right now is kind of getting rid of the Kurds. And for the most part, we don't really want to deal with having the Kurdish army or the various Kurdish People's Protection Units along the border. At least that's the avowed goal that the Erdogan regime has been espousing. And so I think they'll mostly want to remove them. Of course, taking Afrin was an important part of that, their Operation Olive Branch, as they call it. And then taking Manbij will be the next part of that. It remains to be seen whether that will somewhat be the end, whether their goals kind of take over or have their proxies take over the whole of northern Syria that's currently controlled by the Kurds. But that's at least their primary goal right now. They claim that the removing the Islamic State, which was their initial kind of casus belli for entering into Syria, is still a goal. But of course, there's a lot of territory now between the Turkish border and the few remnants of the Islamic State. So if they are going to go forward with that goal, probably take some time. It would probably entail working with one of the various factions that exist in Syria right now to make that happen. And then kind of the last main goal that the Turks have is removing the Assad regime, which I think is somewhat at odds with the removing the YPG and the Kurds, because they were kind of the last main potential barrier to the Assad regime gaining complete control over Syria again, since the rebel forces, which are the ones that the Turks support, are very divided up. I mean, they vary from just groups that happen to be in opposition to the Assad regime to fairly radical Islamic groups. It's just kind of a variety across the board. And they have not necessarily been backed that well. The United States was originally backing some, but there doesn't really seem to be much support there anymore since the United States shifted its focus to the Kurdish units. And I think that's largely the Turkish position. I'll come back to the Kurdish question in a few minutes. Just want to knock the various other states that are involved out. Various states in the Arab Gulf area are involved as well. Saudi Arabia and Qatar have probably been the main two providing funding to the opposition forces, mostly because they want to counter Assad, and Saudi Arabia, being major rival of Iran, wants to counter any Iranian influence. This has somewhat been undermined by the fact that the various Arab countries put a blockade on Qatar last year. So some infighting there, but still some funding going into the opposition forces. Jordan is mostly providing aid to refugees right now. They have undertaken a few airstrikes against the Islamic State, but they've been pretty singularly just moving against the Islamic State in above themselves and not really getting involved with some of the more complicated political issues in Syria. And then really the most recent power to get involved is Israel, which only recently started providing support to the rebels in the end of 2017. And this is especially after the United States started pulling their funding from the rebel groups. And their main goal is probably keeping the Shiites, kind of the Iranian Hezbollah alliance, away from their border. And of course, also making sure the Islamic State stays away from their border. But right now they're so far out to the east that that's probably not an issue. I think one kind of the strange things about Israel is that while the Assad regime has been favorable to that Shia alliance between Hezbollah and Iran, actually the Syrian border region with Israel has been fairly peaceful under the two Assads, Hafez and Bashar, the current Assad. And even though the Golan Heights is somewhat controversially occupied by Israel, that has been a very peaceful border. So I don't really think that Israel, at least right now, necessarily wants to get rid of Assad, because at least that has proven to be peaceful. And of course, Israel is usually having quite a few military and foreign problems along their borders. So it's beneficial to them to try to keep that as stable as possible. Then to go back to the issue with Turkey and the Kurds, and I think it's somewhat prescient that you had mentioned the Armenian genocide, since actually we're coming up on the annual anniversary of that later this month, which this year will be the 103rd anniversary of the Armenian genocide, of which most American states have now recognized it, including my home state of Iowa, which only recognized it last year, and a decent number of European countries as well. But of course, Turkey still actively denies it, and generally will arrest journalists and that sort that are trying to show favor towards it and wanting to get it recognized. A lot of other countries in the world do not recognize it as well, which, of course, is problematic for historical reasons, especially kind of being the first major genocide of the 20th century, as well as being used as an example of genocide by Adolf Hitler when he launched the Holocaust, and also an example of how you could get away with doing that. But I think it's very important that we consider the broader scheme of history in relation to the Kurds, and kind of why Turkey is interested in this area and where it might go. So actually one of the potential ironies is that when Turkey, or the Ottoman Empire at that point, was getting rid of the Armenian population, the ones that were not technically being killed immediately were often being taken into the Syrian desert around the city of Deir Zor. And so there was actually a sizable Armenian population that still lived in Syria up until the Civil War. And kind of that region of northern Syria was actually in kind of the plan that the fragment, the shadow of the Ottoman Empire that still existed at the end of World War I claimed. This was a document, the Misak-i Milli, the National Pact, the Ottoman Empire kind of released at the end of World War I, saying effectively, these are the borders that we want for this rump Ottoman Empire. And those regions were pretty much what Turkey is today, plus northern Iraq and the very northern part of Syria. And sure, that's nearly 100 years ago now. It's probably not that important, but actually Erdogan had cited the Misak-i Milli back in 2016 when referring to Turkish interests in the city of Mosul in northern Iraq. And Iraq felt threatened by that, I think understandably. Understanding the historical trajectory and kind of understanding how Erdogan has had more affinity with the Ottoman Empire lately, that could be very worrying for both Assad and for other groups that may or may not triumph in Syria in the end as well. I'm not sure they necessarily are trying to erase history by any means in that region, but I do think that the Turkish government is potentially making a play to aggrandize their state in some way or another, whether through just the press that might come from being anti-Western and from kind of achieving these victories against the Kurds, who are fairly strongly vilified, at least by Erdogan's constituents inside Turkey, or whether there's some deeper purpose here.
And it's, as you know, in this part of the world, everybody loves a good conspiracy, whether there's a foundation for it or not. So I just wanted to go on. And Turkey has, first of all, it's never been an easy place to try to understand. Since the theoretical attempted coup of a couple of years ago, it's gotten even a little more opaque. But, you know, history is not too far under the surface, especially inside of the last century. And in the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the reconstruction in the from the end of World War I through the 1920s, that area of now Turkey, south of the Iskenderun to the Syrian border, was, if memory serves me right, actually Syrian. You also have, if you look at Afrin province where the Turks have moved in, they're right there up to across the river. I don't think they've crossed the Euphrates yet from the tomb of Suleyman Shah, which was, I believe, one of the founders of the Ottoman Empire. There's a lot there. I think the security for that area has always been Turkish. And on the fringes, you have to wonder if part of the Turkish play is getting a foothold, so when the eventual discussion of what to do with Syria after the civil war takes place, they actually have a chip to play involving some fungible territory. Do you think in the back of Erdogan's neo-Ottoman mind, this might be a play that at least he wants to have in reserve if needed?
I think absolutely. It's definitely an important chip that he can and most likely will play once they come to the table in the end. Whether the peace talks that supposedly are going to happen in Tehran in a few weeks' time will be fruitful, or whether this ends up whether the Civil War itself continues for many more years, which, of course, with loss of life and all the issues therein, I think Turkey will be a player at the table and cannot be ignored, especially now that they have men on the ground, now that they pretty much have actual territory in Syria, whether it's technically controlled by a proxy or not. I think that's absolutely important. As you mentioned, they have not yet crossed the Euphrates. I believe they did come up to the Euphrates border or right along the river a few days ago. So they are definitely going in that direction. It will depend a lot whether in these next few weeks, kind of how far the Turkish government, the military want to push the matter. Since certainly they have a bargaining chip, but at the same time, especially if they take out Membiş, it's somewhat questionable how strong of a potential resistance will exist from the remaining YPG units. I think that they still will control sizable amounts of territory in the northeastern region of Syria, but I think it would be beneficial for the Turkish government, of course, as well as the YPG themselves, to make some sort of accommodation, probably ideally before Membiş falls. But naturally, that's going to be a very hard thing to do. But at least any sort of background or any sort of support or credence that there is to the rumors that the YPG has support to or supporting or support from the PKK, the Kurdish forces in Turkey itself, I think it would be smart for the YPG to disavow those and try to make some sort of accommodation. So certainly, I mean, the Turkish military is one of the best in the Middle East, and certainly the YPG are very unlikely to be able to stand up to that, whether it's Turkish military directly or the proxy forces of the government opposition.
One of the questions being asked in the chat room is, where is Turkey itself going? And I have that question too. I mean, there's been some discussion international relations that China and its One Belt One Road are really interested in Turkey. Turkey's already received some benefits from China in that respect. Is China another one of these players in this game, or is that really an issue? Not that's just a side issue to what's going on in Syria, or is that part of what's going on?
I think it's mostly a side issue. Obviously, the One Belt One Road is important for kind of understanding global politics right now, but it doesn't really affect the Syrian crisis, at least as I see it. I do think it's important that Turkey is potentially going that route, but I do think a considerable difference between Turkey and some of the other countries that traditionally have kind of been party to that One Belt, One Road policy of China is that Turkey's far more established than most of those other countries. So I think Turkey's a little bit more able to potentially push back against Chinese influence and kind of still do its own thing. And I think, especially considering that Erdogan is the current leader, I think Turkey will do its own thing. So I know the One Belt, One Road policy has also been trying to make some inroads into Greece as well, with mixed results, but nonetheless. But I think that is definitely more of a side issue that doesn't come up as much in the Syrian crisis.
You used an interesting term early on in your article over at Small Wars Journal about all the different players that have come into the Syrian conflict just being another spoke on the wheel, crushing all those on the ground. Obviously, it looks like, at least for the northwest part of Syria, that the Turks are the latest spoke of the wheel to come down. Are there other spokes that you could see potentially coming down on Syria in the near future?
That is a very good but very difficult question. I think it's very hard to say, because certainly I don't think that the major players as they are right now will change. At least I don't think it's very likely that we might have another Turkey effectively step into the ring and not really having had that much power in the first place. Potentially Russia or Iran could escalate their involvement in Syria. I think it's incredibly unlikely that the United States will escalate its involvement. particularly since the United States objectives are kind of lined up in a way that doesn't really make sense for military intervention, and I certainly wouldn't support it, nor would I support it in the first place either. But I do think that there are potential things that could happen. Certainly, one of the risks, which I think the United States government found out both in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I think various powers in Syria have understood, it's a lot easier to destroy a territory than actually destroy a faction. And kind of having these various opposition groups kind of continue and still manage to survive, it can be a very tricky thing. So you're almost fighting an unseen enemy at that point. It's a lot easier, I think, at least for press and for gaining support. And I think that's certainly the goal of the Turkish government right now, is that, you know, if they can say, oh, we defeated the YPG at Afrin, that looks really good. And I think there was a study at one point that said that potential support in Turkey for Operation Olive Branch was potentially as high as 90%. I think it was a government-done report, so that number is potentially very unlikely. But I think at least it goes to the point that there is substantial support. But I think even same in any sort of campaign, it's a lot easier to say, here's the territory we're gaining, compared to saying there's some sort of shadowy enemy out there and we're winning, which there's no substantiated proof for that in many cases, or it's not as easily understood by the public as saying, here's this new city that we gained. I do think that in regards to the next turn of the wheel, I think it will largely be where Turkey ends. And if Mount Beige is the end, then that might be when talks try to come to the table and the situation exists as is. If they decide to try pushing further, either into northern Syria, which will allow them to have a very large bargaining chip when treaty eventually, or peace eventually comes down, or if they decide to try moving further south and potentially have a larger role in trying to counter the Assad regime, a much longer operation, potentially much more deadly one. I'm not sure that the Turkish government necessarily do that. I think, obviously, Erdogan has some more authoritarian tendencies and potentially taken some risks, but I think he has obviously been in power for a long time. He's a smart player, and I think he somewhat has to understand the realities of how divided and effectively how weak the anti-government forces in Syria are, especially when the Assad regime is being backed by Russia and Iran, which are not exactly cheap backers and, of course, have lots of resources to bear as well. So it might be of most benefit to the Turkish government, at least as how Erdogan sees it, to kind of use that bargaining chip to gain the influence or gain the prestige that he wants right now.
There was an interesting opinion piece in the Washington Post a few days ago about whether the Obama administration back in 2013, when they said that there was a red line, if Assad used chemical weapons, maybe they should have acted more decisively at that time and been able to peel away Russia and Iran from Assad. Now we're looking at chemical weapons again. But last time President Trump fired off some missiles, and now Russia is saying, don't do that again, basically. Are we just repeating history here and because we didn't learn from it in the past? Or is this, are these stakes being raised to a much higher level at this point?
Sure. So, yeah, I think that the past attack that you mentioned was 2017, that sarin gas attack. And, of course, there was the one yesterday or today, depending on the time zones, which I think is still up for debate. I don't think that the Assad regime has taken ownership of that yet, although it's fairly likely it was the Assad regime that did that. And it violates international law, the Convention of War. Certainly when the civil war ends, I think Assad, whether he's victorious or not, will have to pay a price, or will hopefully have to pay a price in international court. If he doesn't, that's definitely a blow to international law. But as far as it comes to countries, I think it's not necessarily – it's kind of one of those tricky questions of it may be a morally smart decision to fire off missiles or to take some sort of action, like make a strong statement denouncing this other regime for doing this, but there's kind of a difference in realities of whether you're actually going to do this or not and what the political repercussions will be. And I think really certainly France, United States, and various other Western powers have at least pretty strongly, at least for myself this morning, denounced the attack, which they should. But I think an actual military response is somewhat beyond what they're willing to do at this point. Wouldn't necessarily be surprised if there are a few missiles fired, but I certainly don't think any substantive action can be taken. This has happened before, unfortunately, in Syria. Hopefully it won't happen again, but it has happened before, and the reaction has been somewhat mild, all things considered. And I think, actually, kind of in regards to history repeating itself, it kind of brings us back to the Kurds as well, since the United States is the major backer of the Kurdish power, the YPG, in northern Syria at the moment. And there's kind of that decision of, do you want to keep supporting the YPG, but at the same time, it's only going to make relations that much worse with Turkey, which, all things considered, Turkey has been almost one of the most consistent allies of the United States in history. I mean, we had good relations with the Ottoman Empire back when the United States was founded and created, at least the current style of government after our confederation in the 1780s, 1790s. And even during World War One, when the Ottoman Empire was on the opposite side, the United States didn't actually declare war against them because we've had historically very healthy relations with them. And good relations during the Cold War, really good relations to the past few years, kind of starting mostly in the Obama administration and then now into the Trump administration as well. And I think that's a huge ship to lose, especially considering how important Turkey is as a player in the region, not just in the Middle East, but also kind of in the Balkans region. And especially considering that the United States has other allies in the Middle East itself, Israel's longtime ally, Saudi Arabia, other ones kind of been, can vary about whether those alliances exist or not. But I think Turkey is a very valuable one that would be a huge risk. So at the very least, United States, someone needs to take a hard look. On the other end, you have the Kurds, and certainly history has shown the United States is not above kind of using them to an end. And somewhat the other end of the Kurdish United States to an end, gaining more autonomy. And then the United States kind of shucking them off in the end. And, of course, that led to very deadly repercussions in northern Iraq, the end of the Gulf War, and was problematic later on as well during the most recent United States American foray into Iraq. I think it is a major issue that I'll kind of have to come to terms with. At least that's my current modest proposal, I think, is that the United States really should try getting the YPG and Turkey at the same table and kind of also pressuring the YPG to really do away with any sort of ties it may have to the PKK in Turkey and really make it clear that what its interests are, those interests do not conflict and are not at odds with the Turkish government.
It's probably a good thing that this is just an audio show with no with no video, because I may have disrupted things with my facial expression and guffawing when you said international law, not in a happy way, but in a very, very dark way. Because I think, you know, your last comments about convincing the YPG to come to the table is spot on, that this is going to have to be kind of an old school resolution to a regional conflict, because I don't think there's going to be an international solution. You can look at the latest, whether or not that was a chemical attack by the Syrian government or not. It's a sad development that we've seen in the last few years, the renormalization after almost a century of chemical warfare, whether it's on the battlefields of Syria or to eliminate members of the Kim family, or the Russians using chemical along with their little radiation polonium to take care of spies. But there was a call starting today, and looking at the report that came out from Reuters 4 years ago, four hours ago, the Russians evidently, because of course they're reading all of our internal cables of communications, they got they got the jump on everybody today and called for a meeting of the UN Security Council to discuss, quote, international threats to peace and security. And a few minutes later, everybody else in the Security Council, the usual suspects, U.S., France, Britain, Sweden, Poland, the Netherlands, Kuwait, Peru, and the Ivory Coast said, no. Let's talk about the chemical weapons attack in Syria. And, of course, Russia is playing their great bureaucratic game of, no, we called first. We get the meeting first, which we all know how that's going to play out. So you really are going to have to and when people call for U.N. intervention, let's be honest here. They're talking about U.S. military intervention, other nations coming along and aside. And I don't think there's any indications that either the Trump administration or the American people have any appetite of doing any more boots on the ground than we already have in Syria. So if you take the logical step of that, then you're going to be in a situation where the local power players are the ones that are going to have to either make it happen or not make peace happen. Do you see any hope out there, any way, shape, or form, that that post-World War II international structure, imperfect as it is, but it has been useful on occasions, is actually going to be any more than a virtue signaling player as Syria gets near the eventual exhaustion point of their civil war? Or is this just going to have to be what you outlined before, that the people who own territory and have young men and women standing on street corners saying this land is ours are going to have to come to the table and beat out a solution that makes everybody, like all deals in the Middle East have to, where everybody walks away to the table feeling they got a little bit from the other person, but they got enough that's okay for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think largely it will end up being kind of that old-style deal of how wars usually end, of having everyone come to the table and eventually pick up the pieces and figure out what's going to go into the future. I think in the aftermath of that, I hope, and very strong emphasis on hope, because I'm not sure what necessarily the realities are, but I think it's very important that we end up actually having international law play a role in at least making everyone accountable that had some sort of role in this war, whether it's the Assad sarin gas attacks, whether it's war crimes in Raqqa or other Islamic State territories, even some of the looting that happened in Afrin when the Turkish-backed forces took it over. I think that's definitely very important. I know there are a variety of groups, including ones actually, present amongst various law schools, that are trying to keep track of that and kind of following various media sources and kind of making sure there's a running catalog of all the various war crimes that are going on right now. And therefore, hopefully hold the commanders, the political leaders, even the soldiers responsible for these various crimes once the war eventually ends. Of course, kind of as we have seen, especially one of the probably the best examples is with Yugoslavia and the international court relating to that, just how long it's taken. I mean, there are still trials going on effectively right now, and they kind of are wrapping up at least, but still, I mean, the wars in Yugoslavia ended 20 years ago at this point. And granted, the judicial system is very slow in the United States, it's slow in India, it's slow across the world, but hopefully international law has a point here. So I think that it could be a very important the power, and certainly I don't think anyone disputes that the Assad regime and various other powers, be they foreign powers or various factions inside Syria, have committed international crimes.
Yeah, international law gets enforced by the winners, sadly. I keep looking at the Kurds, since I'm older than you guys quite a bit, I keep looking at the Kurds potentially being the Montagnards of the modern day, where we induce them to help fight and then abandon them, not necessarily willingly, but just because that's the way it works. And it reminded me of that Kissinger quote about America has no permanent friends or enemies, but only interests. I mean, that's true of every country, I guess. So is that applicable in this case? Is all we're looking here is that's why I asked about the interests, I think, at the start of the show. You know, what is people's goals? Is that the key here? And we know what do the Kurds want out of this? They want their own country. When they sit down at the table, who's going to, they're not a very powerful force in that they're not a nation state, but what would they be looking at? Just a safe zone? Where can they end up?
Sure. So I think that's kind of a two-part question. So first one, kind of in the Kissinger quote, as you mentioned, that America has no permanent friends or enemies, only interests. I know that when I was reading the comments when you had posted this article on the blog, that it had one of the commenters had actually put that quote in, along with a quote from Lord Palmerston as well, that we have no eternal enemies, we have no perpetual enemies, our interests are eternal and perpetual, and those interests is our duty to follow. And I think it's an accurate view of foreign policy, cynical, but an accurate view that, you know, at the end of the day, as much as you might be buddies with another country, certainly like the United States and the United Kingdom generally have very closely aligned interests, but at the end of the day, if those slightly diverge, who's the United States going to support, the British or the United States? And I think the answer for that is fairly easy. I think that becomes tricky in Kurdistan, the Kurdish region of Syria, particularly because how we use or how the United States uses its own interests or doesn't or does support the interests of foreign powers or opposition groups, Montagnards or the Kurds, is very important to how the world sees the United States and how the United States can potentially use foreign policy in the future. And it's a terrible foreign policy decision if you just kind of throw off your ally when you're done using them or it becomes inconvenient, just because who's going to support you in the next war, the next conflict, when it's clear that you can't be trusted. I think the other end of that, of course, you don't want to support someone to the own detriment of your own country, which becomes a very tricky question. Certainly, as I mentioned earlier, the United States has thrown off the Kurds before. It's foreseeable that it might happen again. And so the aftermath of that is, you know, if the United States ends up having to be involved in the Middle East in Next Generation, is it likely that the Kurds will again come to the table and want to have support from the United States? I think it becomes more questionable when this continues to get this way. I think as to your second question, the Kurdish interest and kind of what they want, somewhat varies based on the country around. So definitely PKK in Turkey kind of want autonomy at least, or a sort of independent state. Doesn't necessarily follow since the PKK is just one subsection of the Kurdish population. There are many who are kind of working in the political system there. The HDP, which is a political party in Turkey, which is officially a green party, but has strong Kurdish interests and does very well in the Kurdish regions, working to the political system and kind of integrating more and kind of having more respect for Kurdish rights in addition to those of ethnic Turks. So I think that's kind of one side, but in Syria itself, with the Kurds, there is definitely kind of an interest and at least in establishing safety for those that live in the Kurdish region. I think autonomy or at least a potential autonomous role would be important and could be something that they would negotiate for at the table. I'm not sure I necessarily see it as them trying to become independent. There hasn't really been the same sort of referendum that Iraqi Kurds had back at the end of 2017. So I'm not sure they would go that far, especially kind of as I mentioned earlier, they haven't necessarily been in direct conflict with the Assad regime either. So it remains to be seen how that will kind of play out in the coming weeks and coming months.
Yeah, I think at the in the end, nobody is really going to be happy or pleased with what really is a tremendous human tragedy that at the end of the day is probably going to see the Assad family still with its grips on control of before the Civil War, regardless of everything else you wanted to look at in a troubling part of the world, at least in many parts of its civil society, Syria used to be one of the more secular, tolerant of minorities, both ethnic and religious, and diverse countries in that part of the world. What comes after this civil war, and it's going to be different. And I appreciate the fact you come on, Michael, for the full hour to discuss. And for the listeners, I know you've got a little thing called law school at no slack law school that you're at either that chews up a fair bit of your time. But you've obviously have the education and the passion in this area. Are there some other works that you might be publishing soon that if the listener wanted to keep an eye open for your future work, they could look at?
Sure. So I generally post anything that I publish, at least will go up on at least related to the Balkans or the Middle East, will go up on my personal blog, which is Balkanium blog, WordPress, which I can send you a link afterwards as well.
Please.
For right now, what is planned, which is actually more to the American foreign policy side, I have a piece coming out actually this week, and then there'll be a response piece early next month, which will be with EIR, so, Electronic International Relations, and one of the blogs they have on there. So I think the first one is planned to come out on the 12th later this week, and the next one should be sometime in early May as well, but both related to this exact same issue.
Perfect. Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Look forward to reading more stuff from you, Michael, and look forward to next chance to talk to you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure indeed.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael. Enjoy it.
And thank you very much for joining us for today's MidRats. Until next time, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.